Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Mito Action's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Pamela Tucker, PT, DPT from Children's Institute of Pittsburgh and UPMC, is joining us to expound on implementing and introducing principles in aquatic therapy. My name is Stephanie Harry, Patient Support Coordinator at Mito Action, and I'll be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on Mito Action's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in the space today, but it's really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not the chat. It helps me to stay better organized when we kick off our Q&A time at the end of the presentation. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. Aquatic therapy is a topic that our patient community has circled back around to time and time again. I've heard patients share such amazing experiences that they've had with this form of physical therapy and listen to other families who are very curious ask really interesting questions. So, with this in mind, it seemed quite fitting to bring Pamela Tucker into this space. She is passionate about aquatic therapy and has used it with her patients over the years. She has the unique experience of working with both mitochondrial disease and fatty acid oxidation disorder patients. So, she really understands some of the challenges that our community faces. Aquatic physical therapy provides a supportive environment to address a wide range of functional goals, such as muscle strengthening, enhancing postural control, increasing core stability, reducing muscle stiffness, and facilitating mobility. This discussion will review the principles of exercise and aquatic environment and explore how aquatic therapy can positively impact your health with a mitochondrial condition. As always, the session today is being recorded, and we encourage you to share this session not only with others in our Mito community, but also with your clinicians and current physical therapists as you explore if there might be a benefit in aquatic therapy for your health. If you're a clinician watching this after this session, Pamela has included her personal email at the end of today's presentation, so don't hesitate to reach out to her. She is an amazing collaborator. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Pamela Tucker. Following her undergraduate studies at Duke University, Pamela Tucker obtained her Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Franklin Pierce University. Her clinical experience includes management of outpatient and inpatient rehabilitation of infant, pediatric, and adult populations. She is a senior physical therapist at the Children's Institute of Pittsburgh and UPMC with specialties in pediatric, neurological, vestibular, and concussion interventions. Her research interests include physical therapy interventions for children with inherited metabolic disorders, aquatic physical therapy, concussion management, and robotic-assisted mobility training. Dr. Tucker is currently working on a physical therapy protocol for recovering from rhabdomyolysis. Thank you so much, Pamela, for joining us today. We are so excited for your presentation and for all that we are going to learn. So, without further ado, go ahead and get started.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be able to share with you guys aquatics and my experience with it, and I welcome any questions that you may have. As Stephanie mentioned, my name is Pamela Tucker. I graduated from Duke University and Franklin Pierce University. I'm currently working at the Children's Institute in Pittsburgh, as well as UPMC Shadyside. My disclosure is I am an advisory committee member for Ultragenyx, and that is current. So, today, as Stephanie mentioned, I would like to define aquatic physical therapy and the processes needed to start this as a modality if that's appropriate for you and your care. I'd like to talk about precautions and contraindications to aquatic therapy, as well as some of the physical and physiological values of this versus land-based therapy. I'd also like to talk about some of the principles and the physics of working in water versus on land, because they are very different environments and we have to keep different things in mind. And that trails nicely into how different exercises in the water can help with addressing concerns like low muscle tone and low energy. And that like to conclude with talking about how you can collaborate with your therapist and talk about different questions and education to bring up to them, but that's starting your plan of care. First of all, what is aquatic physical therapy? So this is evidence and skill-based practice of therapy in the aquatic environment. It is completed by a physical therapist. It can also be done by a physical therapist assistant under the supervision of a physical therapist, which would mean that you work with a PTA for a certain number of visits, and then you are reassessed by the PT to see if this is still appropriate and you're making progress towards your goals, followed by more sessions if indicated with the PTA. And it includes treatment, rehabilitation, health optimization, wellness, and fitness in an aquatic environment, and it can or cannot include equipment. One of the biggest questions I always get, particularly when I work with kids, is can I teach how to swim? So, unfortunately, I am not allowed to teach swimming. It has to be, at least in the US, this has to be a skilled intervention to address certain impairments working towards functional goals. Swimming lessons themselves, I can provide community resources for, but if the goal is I want to be able to swim across a pool, unfortunately, we're not mermaids, and insurance doesn't let me seek reimbursement for that, and is not considered a skilled activity provided by a therapist. So there have been multiple studies showing that this modality is very beneficial for a broad variety of diagnoses. The evidence, unfortunately, is still lacking in the metabolic community. As of even last night, when I double-checked to see if anything was pending or newly published, unfortunately, only my case study has looked at any aquatic therapy for patients with FAODs. As of yet, this is an area that definitely needs a bit more research to see how this population performs in the aquatic environment and what sorts of intensities, duration we need to look at to maximize their progress. So the process for starting aquatic therapy, you would start with a script for a physical therapy evaluation from your physician. Then you would complete an evaluation and assessment with a therapist knowledgeable in aquatic therapy. Once you are cleared and provide consent for aquatics, which can vary from facility to facility, the therapist writes up their plan of care, which is returned to your physician for another sign-off, and you can start physical therapy. Usually, how this process looks is I may write a plan of care saying, we need a certain amount of weeks in the pool, followed by a reassessment on land to see what sort of progress we're making and what barriers we're encountering, and to double check that this is still the best treatment option for you. We may also alternate. We may say, okay, 1 week we'll be in the pool, 1 week we'll be on land. It can vary depending on how you're presenting. To qualify for aquatic therapy, we have to be able to identify certain impairments, which can be minimized in the aquatic environment. We also have to identify functional goals or outcomes that improve your quality of life or the burden of care. So by that, I mean, I frequently have parents or patients come in and say, my goal is to improve my core strength. I would challenge you to think of what sorts of functional goals you're working towards, because improving core strength is something pretty much everyone could work on. I could work on it, Stephanie could work on it, my husband, like all of us could have stronger core strength. But I challenge you to think, what do you want that core strength for? Do you want it so that you're more stable when you're going up and down stairs? Do you want more core strength so that you can balance while putting on your shoe in the morning? What would that core strength translate to? Do you need it so that you can pick up your child or your grandchild without feeling off balance? Those are the kinds of things that I can ask insurance for reimbursement for, and I can use to justify therapy. A goal of pure core strength, usually I redirect to something like athletic training. To become an aquatic physical therapist, there are certain education requirements. for instance, water safety, risk management. Some of these vary depending on the facility that the therapist is working at. Some are more rigorous than others. I found that academic medical institutions typically have the more intensive course and certification training. Your therapist can have completed their certificate in aquatic physical therapy competency, which involves a course, a pool clinic, and learning billing and coding for the pool. And you can feel free to ask your therapist about that, about their experience in the pool, what sorts of training they have. There are additional trainings in different techniques. For instance, I am additionally trained in Bodrogaz and Burdenko method. So I would ask them, I would say, okay, what sorts of techniques do you use in the water? What's your philosophy? Where did you learn the skills that you use in the pool? The water is a fantastic environment, and I love getting patients in it because it is a very supportive environment. And because of the global resistance it provides, it can be very functional. So when we move, we typically are working in a certain plane of movement, and the water can guide stability in other planes to let us really focus on targeted areas. It's also very holistic and functional. It's typically a relaxing environment, and it can be very motivational for people. Most therapy pools are around 93 degrees. That is thermoneutral for skin. I will say for my more active kiddos, I usually lower the temperature to around 91 degrees because they'll be getting in and out of the pool, jumping. Just to keep them from overworking and overheating, we keep the pool just a little cooler. More standard pools that you might have seen for like swim athletes or divers, those are typically around 80 degrees. I do want to go just a little bit into some of the principles of water that we use in therapy. So I use buoyancy all the time. It's that upward force that opposes gravity, and I use that to help offload. And by that, I mean, if you are around your ASIS, which is around your waist level in the water, 50% of your body weight is offloaded. If you're staying in one place, things change a little if you are running or jumping or things like that. The deeper you are, the more of your body weight is offloaded, and that can really let you be more supported and have less fear and risk with falling while we're working on some more challenging skills. As I mentioned, that offloading is when you're in a static position, so meaning staying in place. It does change a little bit when you're moving around, which is something your therapist will keep in mind. We use three different components of buoyancy with the exercises that we do. So there's buoyancy assisted, buoyancy supported exercises, and buoyancy resisted. And I'll have some pictures on the next page to give you an idea. So buoyancy assisted, you're using that upward movement of the water to assist you. So in this picture here, you can see this young woman working on several different things. So with that really exaggerated large step forward, she is not only working on her balance and her strength in her glutes and her hip flexors, she's also getting a really good dynamic stretch on her hamstrings as she's walking. Here, we're doing a more buoyancy supported activity. So we're looking more to offload. This I would use in more targeted weakness. So a lot of the kids that I get into the water, and adults too, tend to have weakness here where she's moving on the sides of her hips, where she brings her legs in and out like she's making a snow angel. These muscles stabilize our pelvis as we're walking and running and going up and down stairs. And we tend to neglect them a bit. We tend to favor working on our quads, our glutes, or our hamstrings. So this is a great activity to work more for stabilization and balance while doing functional mobility, moving about our day. This next picture shows buoyancy resisted exercises. So you're moving against that upward force for more of a strength challenge. So here, her back is against the wall. She's in a bit of a squat position, so she's engaging her legs, her core, And she's making it a bit more challenging by moving her arms downward into the water with that kickboard. Another consideration we keep in mind with aquatics is hydrostatic pressure. So I'm sure you've seen things like if you take a balloon and you put it in the water, it compresses. As you go deeper and deeper into the water, the pressure increases. This can impact swelling, which is a great thing, especially if you are coming in after an orthopedic injury. But it also does affect the cardiovascular and respiratory systems. Breathing can be more challenging as you go deeper in the water because of the pressure being exerted on your rib cage. It's a little bit more work and more energy expenditure. I'm a scuba diver, so I love seeing things like this where you see the bottle of water, which was full on land, being squashed once you get deeper into the water. And once again, as a scuba diver, I found this story very inspirational where this father, his son had a tumor removed and unfortunately was paralyzed. So he used hyperbaric training and aquatic physical therapy to make him or work on his ability to be able to walk again. And he was able to restore his function. And this young man is able to walk and is in Florida getting his PhD. So I thought that was pretty amazing. As I mentioned, as you go into the water, the pressure exerted on your cardiovascular system will change some of your perceived values. So one of the things I use to monitor intensity is heart rate. Your heart rate will actually decrease in the water. It depends on the depth, but around 11 to 15 beats a minute. So anyone who wears a waterproof wearable, that's something to keep in mind when you're doing exercises in the pool. Next is viscosity. That's another principle of water, which is the friction between the molecules of a liquid, and it has them adhere. So this is why when you walk out of a pool, you're carrying some of that pool with you for a while, why there's all this water stuck on you for a bit. That's something that I always want to keep in mind because as you are finishing your session and leaving, we need to make sure that you have enough gas in the tank to be able to deal with that work of leaving the pool and getting to get changed, leave the clinic, get back home, and do all of your daily activities. One of the great things with viscosity is it can resist movement depending on speed and surface area. So we use different equipment in the pool to challenge your strength and your balance in different ways. The fantastic thing is because of viscosity, your balance reactions can be a bit more supported and prolonged, which let you focus on training, for instance, your ankles or your hips to shift and all those muscles to engage together before you have to take a step. It's a very functional place to work on balance if that's a goal that you have. So as you can see here, this is a sample of an exercise where she's balancing on one leg while trying to get the ring with her other foot. And you can see it's challenging. Her weight is shifted over, but she's still able to stay upright because of the viscosity of the water. So there are some precautions with aquatic therapy. So precautions for us are sort of like yellow flags. It's things that I would say, okay, do we proceed forward or not? It's like proceed with caution. They aren't absolute contraindications where I say, no, absolutely not. You cannot get in the water. For instance, highlighted here is fear of water. I have gotten people into the water who did have a fear of water, but it's very situational dependent. So if you have any of these conditions, I would be open with your therapist about it and talk about a game plan of how you'd like to address them. This next page is list has a list of contraindications for aquatic therapy. So these would be reasons I would say, no, we cannot use the pool, or at least today we cannot use the pool. Listed here, you'll see some different equipment that we use in the pool. So things that assist movement can include barbells, cuffs, belts, kickboards, and noodles. And you can see those lined up on the side of the pool there. Pictured is also an example of what a therapy pool might look like. So this platform that we're standing on, it raises and lowers sort of like an elevator, and the floor has a treadmill built in. Not all therapy pools will look like this. Some will look more traditional. Some will be larger than this. But this is a nice idea, and this was a very nice setup where you can see the television on the wall where it had underwater cameras to let us see what exactly we were doing underwater and give real-time feedback. There are different pieces of equipment that I use to resist movements using principles of drag and viscosity, which I mentioned before. So these are paddles and weights, different fins. We also use very functional equipment. So these are things that you might have seen at traditional pools or played with yourself, like rings and balls. Rails are another example of very functional equipment we use in the water. So something that I've spoken about before, if you've ever been kind enough to listen to me before and been willing to come back again, is intensity. There is some evidence to support that interval training of a higher level with some modifications, so HIIT exercises, could be beneficial to patients with metabolic conditions. Now, intensity on land is different than intensity on the water. Water is lower impact. It allows us to do exercises with less stress on our joints, muscles, and bones. However, low impact does not necessarily mean low intensity. A challenge for therapists is that land intensity is mostly quantifiable. So, for instance, if I have you working on a treadmill, I can see the miles per hour that you're going. If I have you doing an exercise with a resistance band, those are graded based on color for certain pounds per square inch. I can quantify how much body weight support I give you, how much weights I'm using. In the water, things are a bit more nuanced in terms of all these different factors coming together. Buoyancy and resistance are combined with different equipment. You can change the depth of the water, the temperature. A person's body composition can change how the exercise is performed and what sort of resistance and intensity they're feeling. Again, your heart rate, I would expect it to reduce around 10 to 15 beats a minute in the water. That changes once again based on the depth. So, one of the measures, and you'll see it on the next slide, that therapists usually use to gauge intensity is heart rate or a rate of perceived exertion scale, which translates to heart rate. Once again, this is just something for you to keep in mind and to talk with your therapist to define target zones for yourself. And I can go over how to find those zones again if you're interested. But making sure that while you do different exercises, if you follow interval training, that you are hitting those targets with recovery times to maximize both your performance and your gains and your overall recovery. Here on the left side, you'll see that Borg scale that I was mentioning. So that's the rate of perceived exertion that translates over to heart rates and lets you see what exercise zone you're in. So you can see like not difficult, moderate, vigorous, extreme. Related to that, in the water, a test that I've used is a talk test, which translates pretty well to the Borg, and I would encourage you to consider using. Especially since we expect your heart rate to be a little different than how it'd be if you were doing land-based exercise. And the talk test is like it sounds, where you're doing some talking with me, and I'm using that as a gauge of how you're performing the exercise, how intense it is. This next slide goes over how we recommend and prescribe aquatic therapy. So, your physician will not be able to determine how many visits you get, I have patients who come in who will say, oh, the physician said I should come in 4 times a week for aquatic therapy. That would be a little like me telling a doctor, I think you should give him this dosage of insulin 2 times a day. It doesn't impact my plan of care. He can recommend therapy, and then from there, I determine how intense, how long, those sorts of things. We collaborate together, but just to set that expectation, the physician may write one thing, but your therapist is the one who will determine how many times a week you're coming, how long the sessions are, and things like that. But it is collaborative. You are involved in that process. So typically, if it's a new condition, so say you're coming to me after an orthopedic injury or say after a metabolic crisis, that's considered a new event to me. And I would typically recommend somewhere around 2, possibly 3 times a week, depending on what sorts of goals we have. I do include a warm up and a cool down phase with all my aquatic programs. In the active phase, with patients with metabolic conditions, especially, I would aim for some intervals that moderate to high intensity activity with lower intensity activities interspersed. Typically, sessions can run 45 to 60 minutes. Very rarely have I seen people get in the pool for just 30 minutes, and sometimes 60 minutes can be a little bit long. 45 tends to be a pretty good spot for most patients. And the state of the evidence currently looks for around 12 weeks of therapy. Now, that may change depending on how you present. If you are presenting with more traditional orthopedic injury, you sprained your ankle and you're working on just regaining some motion and working on walking and running, things like that in the water, that may be shortened to maybe we only do 6 or 8 weeks in the pool. We do reassess regularly, like I mentioned before. So we may have a set period where, okay, let's do 4 or 5 sessions in the water and reassess on land, and then see if we need to do more sessions in the water or transition to more full-on land-based sessions. It's very fluid and individual specific. Pictured here are some different exercises that I've used with my patients in the water. So it can be very vast. There are so many different things we can do in the water, and it's very goal dependent. Really, the ocean's the limit. There can be so many different things that we can do. I do recommend throughout all this process that you talk with your therapist. Certain things to keep in mind are you want to make sure you fuel yourself for your activities before, during, and after your sessions. As I mentioned, if you do implement an interval training program, take those lower intensity intervals to maybe get a quick boost, whatever that looks like for you. I've had patients bring in Gatorade with a little additional sugar, have snacks nearby. I've had patients eat within half an hour before coming to see me, just certain things like that. As I mentioned, consider trying some interval training with modifications rather than steady state exercise, especially if your session is being stretched out for an hour, because that's a long time in the water, working at a higher rate than you usually perceive. I do strongly recommend you combine aquatic and land-based PT, because as much as I wish we aren't mermaids, and everything we do has to translate to the land. Plan ahead for your energy costs. And ask about different assistive devices that you can use in the pool. For instance, I've used devices like AFOs, which are ankle foot orthoses, to help with foot drop. For instance, if I've had patients who their goal is working on walking and they have foot drop, but we have other goals that we want to work on first, then I can take away some of the effort and the work by stabilizing the ankle joint to allow them to work more on their hip flexors and their quads for that walking task. So there are certain modifications we can make. I also strongly encourage you to ask about how to progress flexibility, because we know that tightness, especially in the hamstrings and the calves, can be a concern in this population. And the water is a fantastic environment to work on stretching. as you might have seen in that earlier picture with the buoyancy assisted walking that the girl was doing, where she stepped forward and her leg was really straight. The water can be a great modality for gentle stretching, and a lot of people tolerate it better than they do stretching on land. So I do want to open it to questions because I know Stephanie has told me that there are quite a few about this. Thank you for your patience with that. Let me stop sharing so we can see each other in chat.
Thanks so much, Pamela. This is really helpful and informative. And I just encourage everyone to continue to put your questions in the chat. I think there's a lot to break down and be discussed here. And I think I'm really excited to just dive right in. One patient asks, how do we know that our referring PT has access to water for aquatic therapy? And I would also ask, add-on there, if you're already seeing a land PT, and you're interested in aquatic therapy, should your land PT be able to refer you to, or do you need to find a PT that can do both?
So you can ask your land PT, and they should be able to give you a list of clinics in the area that have a pool if their clinic does not have one. You, depending on your state, may need your script to state aquatic physical therapy. Usually what I do is if I think my patient's appropriate and if I don't have access to a pool, I would call the doctor and say, I think they need aquatic therapy. Could you adjust the script to say aquatics? And then give the patient a list of check out these clinics and see which one you like the look of the best.
So will your aquatic therapy automatically do some land PT with you then as well?
Yes.
So you mentioned in one of the slides about precautions in regards if your diet if you have diabetes. So we have a couple of patients that asked why? why is diabetes considered contraindicated and maybe what your experience are? I know there's a couple of patients that do have diabetes that are using aquatic therapy, but what are the concerns there?
Yeah, so just a precaution, not a contraindication. The things that we keep in mind are if there's neuropathy going on, there because the water obscures where your feet are, there could be an injury that happens that isn't felt. Also, we want to keep in mind fuel, like with that patient population, separate from metabolic concerns, their fuel during their sessions, and basically, what do we do if they become underfueled while performing an exercise in the water, because that's, I have had patients, thankfully not in the water, but on land, who, for instance, needed an emergency, like we need to sit and have orange juice. So we have to keep that in mind of how do I safely get you out of the water so I can refuel you.
That's good. I think that's important, whether you're diabetic or, you know, for a lot of our mito patients with fluctuating blood sugar issues. How do you talk to your PT about that, especially if maybe they're not aware with certain mitochondrial conditions or metabolic conditions that blood sugars and fueling is an issue? Like how do you approach that with your therapist?
So, I would say if your therapist isn't familiar, I would encourage them to, they have, you can feel free to give them my email. You can refer them to some of the literature that's out there. I'll speak for Dr. Balkley and say he's a fantastic resource and he has a lot of research that's out there so they can inform themselves a bit more. But you also are a great source of information for them and can tell them things that have been successful before. So if you have done exercises and you said, it didn't go well when I did this, when I just had water during it, but it did go well when I brought this with me. Even if it wasn't a land session, if it was, or sorry, even if it wasn't while you were in a pool, if it was a land exercise, that's information I can carry with me and say, of course, yeah, we can have those things in the pool. We can maybe save you some energy. They have wheelchairs that bring patients directly into the pool, so that can save you a little bit of energy on entering and exiting. They're just things that we can think about and be flexible with.
I think that's really helpful, this idea that maybe there's other things that can save energy to getting to and from the pool, because you did talk a little bit about the importance of navigating. I took notes when you said this because you were talking about the importance of navigating having enough energy, because you have to think through, like, when you're on land, it's like when you're done, then you maybe go to your car, right? You do a cool down. But when you're in the pool, you have to do all the things, including maybe getting out of your swimsuit and like and trying and that takes a lot of fine motor skill and that takes extra energy. How do you work with your PT to kind of manage this, especially if you've not tried aquatic therapy before, to know what all energy it could take, but also, like you mentioned, maybe you take the wheelchair into the pool to save some energy. Are there other energy saving things that you can explore while you're trying to figure out how to keep that time safe?
Yes, so definitely entering and exiting that can be modified. All therapy pools should have a lift that can get you in and out if they don't have a wheelchair. I would say maybe consider starting a little deeper in the water too. That would offload you a little bit more and save you a little bit of that ground reaction force and your energy to do more during therapy without having quite as much cost. Now, that does vary a little depending on some of the exercises they're having you do, but if they're not having you do high, heavy resistance when you're very offloaded, then being deeper could be a way to save you a little bit of energy.
Another patient asked, she said previously she could stay in the water for about an hour and a half, but now her limit is about 45 minutes. She said, if I stay over an hour, I'm exhausted for about a week or so. Do you have any thoughts on causes of this or how these things change?
Is it the same pool or is it a new pool? Did anything change, like the temperature of the pool, what you were doing in the water? I'm impressed. An hour and a half is a long time in the water.
But these are all good questions, and if this patient wants to put a couple more clarifications in the chat, we can come back to that. But asking those questions, maybe there is a temperature change going on that you're unaware of, or if it is a new space or facility.
I also want to throw out there something to consider is the weather outside. So most pools for physical therapy are indoors and they're heated. There is a bit more work on your body to go from the cold exterior environment, get off all your layers, get in your swimsuit, get in the pool, and then go back to that environment afterwards because just all the changes that your body is going through, that's something to keep in mind as we're approaching hopefully nicer weather.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. A lot of times we don't think about the adaptations our body has to make to and from facilities with the weather change. Oh, okay. So you mentioned earlier about target zones, and they would love for you to review target zones if you could review that again.
Yes. So when we exercise, there are certain target zones that we aim for. Let me go back to that slide. On the leftmost column, this is the Borg exertion scale. It goes from 6 to 20. This is an exertion scale that I usually use with adults because 6 to 20 can be a little bit challenging for younger folks to understand. There's a modified version that is a 0 to 10 scale. And basically, I use that. I'll say, okay, 0 to 10, how hard are you working right now? 10 is like the last sprint of a marathon. You're drenched in sweat. You can hardly take another step. 0, you are on the sofa. You're binging some Netflix. That we take that number and it translates over to your heart rate. So depending on your age, there is a max heart rate that we recommend that you exercise at. Typically, that number, we find it by taking 220 and subtracting your age from it, and then multiplying percentages. So you really do not want to work more than 85% of your maximum heart rate. Beyond that, you're just really straining your body and you're not getting the gains that you would like. You're just putting your body through a really, really hard activity. Typically, with high intensity or moderate intensity interval training, we try to get into that moderate to vigorous zone. So you're aiming for that like 70 to 80, maybe up to 85% at the highest of your target of your maximum heart rate, with the intervals coming down to like that 60% area where it's like definitely lighter. You feel like you're doing something, but it's more of a recovery zone.
It makes me wonder too. I was actually typing this, that it makes me wonder too, in regards to the patient that was having change, if you're having certain intensity changes during your PT like visits, that can also probably affect your long-term recovery as well.
Yes. So intensity and progression has to be carefully monitored, and that can be a challenge for therapists in the water. So I would just encourage you to be really open and candid because you're the one living in your body and you're the one feeling the exercise. I can observe things like what I look for are, okay, are your state of talking to me? Is it still a steady sentence, multiple sentences? You're not out of breath at all? Okay, maybe it can be a little more challenging. Okay, is your form starting to deteriorate a little bit? Maybe now I need to back off. So those are things I can observe, and I can look at your heart rate, I can ask your exertion, but you're the one who feels the exercise and can let me know best. Okay, I need a break now, or I need to, this is a little bit too challenging. I need it to be backed off a little bit. I want it to be a challenge, not impossible, but a good challenge.
Another patient, she asked, "Do you have much experience using aqua therapy for POTS, and what adjustments or accommodations do you think you can make for these patients?"
Sorry, I'm just thinking. I think I've only gotten one patient with POTS in the pool. I think most of them have done land-based therapy. And part of that was a bit limited because of COVID, because my pool was shut down for several years. So even if I wanted to get them into the pool, I wasn't able to. Let's see. Things that I would keep in mind would definitely be monitoring their vitals throughout. I would probably the first session gradually immerse in the water and monitor the vitals, like your blood pressure and your heart rate, to see what depths you're tolerating the best.
How many times in general would you recommend if it's not fo wait. How many times in general would you, I don't know if she's asking maybe how many times in general would you recommend PT if it's following a metabolic crisis versus just overall weakness, endurance, and tone? And so I think this is a really important question because I think we definitely have patients that go after an event, but then we also have patients that have found great value in an aquatic therapy because to help with their energy issues, or like you pointed out, even flexibility. And because it's a chronic health condition, it's not going away, right? And so like if you see these benefits, how do you work with your physical therapist and maybe your insurance company to continue to cover it? Because it's not like I tore something and I'm there and it's going to be like a 4 week recovery. What are your thoughts about that?
So I actually love when patients come in. I call it for something like this, I call it just their tune-up, sort of like how you bring your car in to get your oil changed. Like it's running fine, but you want to do some preventative maintenance so that there aren't issues down the line. For instance, as I was telling Stephanie before this, hamstring and flexibility can lead to certain things, like when you're an overambitious therapist, you can tear your hamstring if you don't take the proper steps and are a little overambitious. So if you're in overall good health, but you have goals of endurance or addressing some weakness, inflexibility. If you came to see me, I would say, okay, let's do a short tune-up of maybe let's try 6 to 8 weeks. We'll write out some goals and then reassess at that time to see do we continue or if you have access to a pool, do I give you an exercise program that you can follow and you are able to direct your program from there?
Okay, so there's a couple ways to navigate around that. And if your insurance is kind of forcing you into a situation where you need to take a break, then you might be able to do that and then come back for another tune-up
Yes.
later.
They may discharge you briefly, and I tell patients, please don't see discharges like me pushing you out the door and locking it behind you. You are more than welcome to come back. It just may be that we have to take a break for a period of time, and then you come back and we do another tune-up.
Oh, okay. As summer approaches, is there anything that we can incorporate in our swimming pools?
Absolutely. If you could message me anything you're directly working on, then I could send you some suggestions.
I noticed that you even just had the floater device that a lot of times swimmers use, and I'm forgetting the name of it now. That you could push it down and pull it up, and as a part of your video, and that's something that most pools even have. The kickboards, that was the word I was looking for, available to be able to help with.
Don't tell my clinic director this because I love the equipment they give me, but you really can do so many things with just a pool noodle, a kickboard, and a weight.
Wow. Most PTs, it says, do not have a pool. Do they contract with other venues? Like, how does that work?
Some of them do. For instance, when I was a student, one of my clinical rotations was with a PT clinic that did not have a pool, but they had a contract with a local hotel. So they would go to that hotel and meet the patient there, and they would do aquatic therapy in that pool.
Have you found that PTs have more of an ortho foundation rather than a neuromuscular? Or is there a way to discern where PTs put their emphasis on therapy?
Their graduate education should be fairly evenly split, and our licensure exam is pretty evenly split between orthopedic and neuromuscular, and then it includes a bunch of other things like wound care, cardiovascular, a whole pediatrics, lots of different topics. You can see where your therapist has specialized by asking them their specializations and seeing on their business card if they have any extra letters after their name beyond PT, DPT. More ortho-oriented people may have their OCS, which is their orthopedic certified specialist qualification. For me, I'm pursuing my PCS, which is the pediatric certified specialist. More neuro will have NCS. So I would just be open with them and ask them what they've specialized in, what their training is.
Are there certain conditions that you find, like when you're working with a patient, where you're just like, oh no, this absolutely, like, aquatic therapy would be way better for this patient because of this, 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 and this, versus when you're talking with a patient, you're like, oh no, land therapy is definitely better for this patient because of this, this, and this.
Are you asking, are there certain conditions or are there?
Or certain symptoms, like, 'cause you mentioned in regards to it, to knowing what your goals are earlier in regards to your core strength. And you said, everybody should work on their core, but if your goals for your core strength are, tying your shoes and being able to pick up your child, that might be something we can do on land. So I'm curious if there's certain, like, muscular goals that people might have where you might say, oh, that would be really great to work on in the water, and this is why.
I would say it's very individual specific. I've definitely had instances where families come in and they're thinking pool, but we actually decide on just doing land. And the opposite's happened where they've come in and not thought about the pool at all. And I've said, I think we should do a round in the pool before moving forward. And I think it's just very patient specific, where I try to look at them and see how they're moving and what sorts of goals they have. And I try to keep in mind, okay, would offloading them in the water or adding that more global resistance make faster progress towards the goals? Or like, I don't think there's one or even just a handful of set criteria. It is so individual.
So it sounds like if you've never considered aquatic therapy that, it might be worth talking to your PT about the possibility because there might be value that you don't even realize exists there, and vice versa, I suppose, as well.
I would say so.
So the last question that came through is, it says you talked about target zones with maximum heart rate. You mentioned recovery periods of 60% target rate. Are you saying more of a hit with exercise for short intervals at 70 to 85% with lower in intervals at 60%?
Yes. So, for instance, and your HIIT program can be, it's very individualized and you should talk with your therapist about how to develop it. But just as a, for instance, if you were doing exercises at a 1-to-1 ratio, you could aim for, okay, I'm going to do, as a, for instance, squats for 30 seconds with my goal heart rate during that activity of being 80% of my maximum heart rate. And then I'm going to have 30 seconds of a recovery period where maybe I'm aiming to let my heart rate recover and come down a bit, but I'm moving, I'm maybe doing some walking around, maybe standing and like doing butt kicks or something like that, like slower ones, not jogging butt kicks, but movement that's just less intense for that recovery period.
Okay, so I lied. So we do have a couple more questions that came in. Can you explain what offloading is? Because you keep using it when you're chatting. What does that mean?
Yes. So the deeper you go in the water, the more your body weight is offloaded. So when you are about waist deep in water, you are bearing about 50% of your body weight. The deeper you go, the less you are having in terms of impact and strain. As a, for instance, this was a very funny one in hindsight. I had a patient down in Texas who had a cancer in one of his bones in his leg that was surgically removed. And the physician said for over a year that he could not bear any weight through that leg at all. I talked with the physician because the poor kid was 16 and an entire year is a very long time to exist on just one leg with crutches. And I convinced that surgeon to let me have him 10% weight bearing, which meant that he could be this deep in the pool doing exercises with me. And he did end up being very successful. He did a great job in the water and it helped him for the first time in over a year be able to walk, be able to practice balancing, be able to move that ankle in a more functional way. This was as I was a younger therapist, I didn't realize at the time him being 6'2" and me being 5'4" would make that a very interesting challenge in the water.
That's interesting. But that's brilliant too to be able to offer something else instead of, because I would imagine too, being able to work with a patient at a 10%, he's able to move his body, the rest of his limbs a little bit more regularly instead of having to, that it could potentially correct other things that could have gone awry if you're just not utilizing that leg at all for an entire year.
Oh, he had so much atrophy in his leg. So being able to start bearing some weight through it in the pool, it led to so many gains because that's part of how our bones recover, through that mechanical load of bearing some weight. So that's something to keep in mind too. If you maybe have a metabolic condition, but you're also coming in after an orthopedic injury, because that is a way that you can save some energy in your recovery rather than doing heavier weight-bearing exercises on land where you're having to move your entire body weight. Being offloaded some in the pool can let you work on your strength and your recovery, your balance, and save you some energy in the long run too.
Well, and that makes it that I think is part of why our community is so interested in the aqua therapy is because if on land you don't have enough energy to be able to do certain kinds of exercises your full weight, it can feel very defeating to like try to do X and you still can't do that. But if you're in the water and you're able to offload and then you can move, then you're moving. So it kind of takes out that it creates a gray space and exercise, whereas it's not, I can't do any exercise. There's now like a space that I can do exercise perhaps safely.
It's a great place. I can get patients who are completely wheelchair dependent, standing and moving in ways they can't on land in the water. So I think the water can be very freeing for a lot of people.
When working with our kids in the pool over the summer, what strategies do you use so they know to work, but they also get to play? Like setting it up from the get-go. Do you have any tips or ideas, whether it's using rings or what would your thoughts be around that?
So are we, could I get an age range? Are they early school age? Are they toddlers? Are they teenagers?
Let's do later elementary school and middle school.
Okay. So for them, it depends on what they're interested in. Usually, I will, for instance, around the edge of the pool, I may set up certain targets for them. I have a little boy right now with spina bifida who is very motivated to make large numbers. So I have floating numbers that I'll put around the edge of the pool. One before he's able to get a number, he has to do whatever that number is of an exercise that I choose.
Okay.
And then to get from one end of the pool to the other, I may have him do a certain exercise or it may be a rest break. It depends on what we're doing during the session. But that would be an activity idea where you have certain targets and they have to do a certain number of reps of something or balance for a certain amount of time before they're able to complete that task and move to the next one.
So if you're trying to be more tricky, like about it, so they don't recognize that it's actually PT, do you have any ideas for that?
My best ones are the ones where they don't even realize that they're doing things that I'm wanting them to do. So yes, being very tricky. I think that comes into pediatric PT quite a bit. That same little boy with spina bifida, so his legs are very small and he does no weight bearing through them on land. And I'm trying to work on him being able to stand and do walking while he's in the water. So he's motivated by these little toys that we have that splash water. They like suck it up and splash it out. Hold him like I'll have him kneeling on my hands, and to get to splash mom and dad, he has to kneel up on my hands, or I'll have him on, I have to climb onto the mat to get those toys. That's a big floating pool mat. There are different ways that you trick them a little bit to do what they're motivated for, which somehow always involves splashing.
So splashing is the key there.
It's a big one.
I'm curious if you mentioned about the boy who was paralyzed and his dad worked with him. I'm curious if you can explain a little bit more about how that worked, about his story and how that process worked for him in the pool.
So, I didn't work with this family. They were down in Florida, but the boy had a cancerous tumor that was removed, and he was considered a level C3 spinal cord injury afterward. Now, I didn't see his chart. It was just a news article that I found. I would imagine it was an incomplete injury, meaning that he had some motor and sensory function below that level of injury. So the dad and the therapy team used, dad was a certified scuba instructor. So that's why he brought him down to that depth and was working with him at that level in the pool to use some of those hydrostatic principles to offload him and encourage more blood flow to his muscles. I imagine that he did a lot of almost body weight supported gait training and mobility at those depths before moving up to higher levels. It would be a very interesting case. Like I said, unfortunately, I didn't work on that case and I haven't seen that family's chart, but like I said, as a scuba diver, I found that very inspiring. I have yet to find a clinic that has supported me in letting me scuba dive
Try
with my patients.
it.
Usually we're in more of a traditional pool setting. Not
How
to say
far
it will
down
never
did
happen.
he, how far down was he though at that pool? Because I mean, pools don't typically go, but I don't know. Or was he at a different pole, 20 feet?
As a scuba instructor, I imagine he probably has access to a pretty deep pool. I've gone in, let's see, the deepest diving pool I had, I believe, was like 30 or 40 feet. And
Okay.
it's used as a training area before going out into the ocean.
There's a patient that asked, does aquatic therapy apply for patients with the need to practice breathing muscles? This
Yes.
patient has some choking issues or lower voice due to less strength on breathing muscles.
My immediate answer is yes. If it's choking and swallowing, I would refer you to speech therapy, actually. But if you're having trouble with clearing your lungs in terms of if you get so sick and have mucus buildup, that's definitely something physical therapy works on, typically in the DMD population. It would be a precaution for me with getting you in the pool, though, if that's something that you're interested in, just because of the extra pressure exerted on your chest.
And if there's any follow-up to that, feel free to put some extra comments in the chat. Oh, okay. So he asked, what is second mucus?
Oh, if you were sick, sorry, if you were ill and had mucus, for instance, if you had pneumonia and you had buildup in your lungs, but you were having trouble with that forceful cough to clear it, then that's something that therapy can work on. Speech therapy usually works on swallowing and aspiration.
Yes, okay. Sick mucus buildup. And if you have more questions regards to that too, I can connect you with Pamela and maybe you can talk further with her in regards to if it's something to explore with your PT. But I think that's a really good point because I hadn't really thought, and you did mention how when you're in the pool, how it does affect it is extra on your breathing. I think you talked about that in your presentation. So it's a really good point to think about. Do these therapy pools, are they typically chlorine versus saltwater based, or can you find both?
I have only found chlorinated. There may be saltwater based ones that I just haven't seen or worked at yet.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Pamela, for all of your help. And I'm going to check the Q&A. Oh, okay, wait, there's one more. Did you mention hyperbaric chamber? She said, I think a scuba. She was curious if that could be helpful working with the FAOD community, but it doesn't sound like there's probably much literature there at this point.
My knowledge, there's no literature. So for those who don't know, a hyperbaric chamber is, it sort of looks like this giant pod that you get in. They were originally designed to simulate deep pressure and especially help people recover from something called the bends, which happens if you are at deep pressures, if you're, for instance, diving and ascend too quickly. Essentially, nitrogen builds up in your blood, and it can be a very dangerous condition. So they'll put you into a hyperbaric chamber to gradually bring you up to ground or sea level and help you recover. They have used it some with some neurological conditions, I believe with stroke and MS. To my knowledge, they haven't used it with the metabolic community, and I have not yet. I haven't had access to one, unfortunately, since Duke. They are very big and very expensive, but very cool to play with. So maybe someday.
It's definitely one of those things you want to talk to your doctor about, because I think that there's like mixed reviews in the Mito community right now about that. But it is definitely something that could be an area of exploration in the future. So make sure you talk to your clinician. Always encourage that. But it's a good thing to keep talking about. And so I really appreciate you, Pamela, for taking the time and exploring this topic with us, and for letting us think about all things related to the water and how we can use that in our lives to better our physical activity and our health with mitochondrial disease and fatty acid oxidation disorders. Thank you for your expertise. And if you are a clinician or physical therapist watching this and you want to get in touch with Pamela, please don't hesitate to reach out to her. You can also reach out to me and I can put you in touch with her. My email address is sharry@mitoaction.org. Thank you everyone for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you next month.
Thank you all. Have a good weekend.